last time. And as we saw, it was extraordinarily important to know the purpose for which one came to religion. But above all, there has to be one other thing. Faith in this day and age is not a terribly popular word, because it implies indoctrinations and other things that maybe you are not yet prepared or not yet ready to accept. You should understand that with all the doctrines of Buddhism, the Buddha himself had a very sensible statement. He said, "Don't believe anything whatsoever, because I tell it to you. Only believe it when you have proved it true for you personally." Now, that meant that he had no dissatisfied customers, because they only accepted that which they could accept and that which they truly believed. But he did say something else. He also said, do not deliberately reject something and say, I don't believe it and I never will. It's like putting something on the back burner of the mind and saying, well, I don't believe it now, but who knows, maybe 10, 20 years from now, I will either have more experience or more knowledge, and then maybe it's acceptable. So anything that sounds outrageous or strange or weird or that is just unacceptable at the present time, don't outright reject it. Just sit it on the back burner of your brain and say, well, who knows? I could be different 20 years from now, and maybe I will find this correct. It does not stop you from being a Buddhist that you do not agree with everything the Buddha says. It will stop you from being a Buddhist if you say, I know he's wrong. Because then you will be setting up a duality in which you are right and he is wrong. If you set up that something like this, which says, well, I think he's possibly wrong, but I'm not sure, and I'll wait and see a few years hence, that's fine. Or I don't know. But do not deliberately set up a duality. Leave the mind open, free, and clear. There's a very interesting thing at the beginning of a lot of the scriptures which says, at the beginning of this lecture given by the Holy One, the unbelievers were allowed to depart, or those who did not believe in this particular one were allowed to depart, or those who did not agree completely with the Buddha, did not argue with him, but left it to see what happens. In other words, open-mindedness. But there is one thing on which you do have to agree, and that is that you cannot completely explain you. I think we can all agree on that without any difficulty. You cannot completely explain where you came from, or why you are here. You cannot create a human being. You cannot create life. That being so, there has to be faith in the sense of, I don't know where I come from completely. I do not know that of which I am completely consisting. I cannot explain, I cannot create life. The Buddha found an unborn, undying, uncreated, unchanging. That it is necessary to believe in, that he did find this thing that was unborn and unchanging. Whether you call it a god, whether you call it Allah, whether you call it XYZ, or Darwin's theory, and I don't much care what you call it, so long as you accept that there is something that caused you to come into existence, and will eventually cause you to die, a life spirit, an energy. So long as you accept there is an unborn, unchanging, undying, then we can go. Because that is really all that is necessary for a person to truly open up a holy and religious life within himself. An acceptance of the fact that he is not God, in other words. The next thing that it will be necessary for you to come to the realization of is, I am not God, but there is nothing in me that is not of God. Or, I am not the cosmic Buddha, and there is nothing in me that is not of the cosmic Buddha. For example, I cannot manufacture a hand. or a foot, or a leg, or at any rate, not of the variety that I originally got. But something, it came from somewhere, somehow it was invented, somehow it was manufactured. That will all be explained in karma. These are what the Buddha taught. He says, do not believe it unless you can prove it true for yourself. There will probably be a lot of the theories that I will come out with at this particular lecture, which is on faith and karma. There will probably be a lot of things that you will find very strange and very difficult to believe, but that's just fine. I have proved them true for me. If you wish, you may prove them true for you, or you may use them solely as a means of study. Either way is fine. So, remembering the importance of having faith, remembering that you have to accept the fact that you are not God, and that there is nothing in you that is not of God, we can take it from the reason that one comes to a monastery or comes to religion, which is that one is worried by both life and death and wants some explanations. In actual fact, that very worry that one is worried about life and death and wants some explanations is proof of the fact that you know you did not produce you, that you cannot produce life or kill life. So, taking from the second paragraph on page 155, it is very difficult to be born as a human being and equally difficult to find Buddhism. However, because of the good karma that we have accumulated, we have received the exceptional gift of a human body and are able to hear the truths of Buddhism. We therefore have the greatest possibility of a full life within the limits of birth and death. It would be criminal to waste such an opportunity by leaving this weak life of ours exposed to changeableness. Now, at the beginning of this book, perhaps I should have added this to it, I'm not sure. Chapter 3 gives you the basic original doctrines essential for Zen, which I'd like you to add to that list if you would, or at any rate, the first pages 8, 9, and 10, which are three pages, up to the end of rebirth. This gives you a very clear, very precise, analytical explanation of karma. What Zen does is give you its practical application. You've often heard, I'm sure, people say that Zen is not part of Buddhism. What they are actually saying is that Zen does not theorize. It puts into practice the theories. Zen is the logical outcome of what is frequently called Theravada Buddhism. You should know that, however, that all of Theravada Buddhism contains the whole of Zen, just analyzed out very carefully and very precisely. The oldest method of Buddhism, and there are many, many schools in the Theravada. When I say the oldest, yes, it is the oldest. After all, it's the method Buddha himself used. The forest-dwelling Buddhists, the Dutanga bhikkhus, speak very clearly of almost exactly the same thing that Zen speaks of, but again speaks of it analytically. I say this because when you have read through those first three pages in Zen is Eternal Life, you will have got the analytical version. And when you have done that, you will be ready to work on what I'm talking about today. Now, it says here it is very difficult to be born as a human being and equally difficult to find Buddhism. Zen says there are three stages of human growth or human spiritual development. And these are, in Zen, called the three main kenshos, or the three main times of understanding. In Theravada, they are put rather nicely, with also the explanations of what happens when you do each one. I'll read these two or three little pieces, but you'll find them very useful. A worldling is one who has not yet attained to one of the four stages of what are called noble ones. The fourth stage, by the way, being death. I'm saying that I'm talking about the three stages here. The fourth we will not be dealing with for some time. The first is that of a stream enterer, one who has entered the stream of Nirvana. He is destined to sure and steady progress along the path with no possibility of retrogression or decline in spiritual development, and he will be born no more than seven times. He is characterized by the eradication of three of the ten spiritual fetters. One, wrong idea regarding a self or personality. The idea of self or personality is wrong when it is based on clinging to the five aggregates, name and form, as the real person or self, i.e. thinking that this which we look at is the only thing that really matters, and therefore what we have to worry about is keeping this alive for as long as possible, no matter by what means. In other words, thinking that this is all that matters instead of finding that the real and true you, which is that which animates me, you, and everyone else here. A person who has become a stream entrant is one who has realized that the true being, the true spirit, is that which is the true him, and that this external thing, with all its ideas and its notions, this is not the real person. That's the first sign of being a stream entrant. The second one is the lack of doubt or hesitation. This is doubt or hesitation or uncertainty in the belief in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Belief in the Buddha, doubt which comes up of, I wonder if there is an unborn, an undying, an uncreated. In other words, is it worth it? What's the point of it all? Doubt that turns into eventually despair and eventual spiritual death, because that is the logical outcome of that type of doubt. If you don't believe that there's something more than this, then all you're going to do is pay extraordinarily high doctor bills and a number of other things to just keep this psychophysical thing alive long beyond its rightful time. And you will die a most unfortunate and most unhappy death, because there will be no certainty in it. You have to believe, therefore, that there is an unborn, an undying, and an uncreated. When you have got to that stage, you are already part of the way to being a true stream entrant. To take refuge in the Dharma, that is to seek out that which tells the truth, that which makes for peace of mind, calm, and above all, for responsibility. I cannot emphasize the importance of responsibility enough in this. Zen does not make you irresponsible. If it does, it is not Zen, it is quietism. And I'm going to go into that in detail towards the end of this particular lecture. It's very important not to get caught in quietism. Responsibility is almost the key word to being a true Zen priest. So, to take refuge in the Dharma, to take refuge in the teachings that are true, to take refuge in the Sangha, i.e. to talk to people who may or may not know more than you do with an open mind, to discuss what you are thinking, to discuss what you know, above all to discuss it with the priesthood, but even more so to discuss it with people who truly believe that there is an unborn, undying, and uncreated. Do not discuss it with people that may turn you into a sort of flaccid lump of hopeless despair. It is implicit in this that you go and find people that are useful, not useless. If they make you feel worse, then it's bad. If they make you feel better, that's fine. So this is the second sign of being a stream entrant. The third sign, this is an interesting one. A person who clings to the efficacy of rites or rituals has not entered the stream. Belief in the efficacy of rites and rituals over the effects of karma, which is a cause of superstition, black magic, and ritualism. If I do such and such, that will wipe out the consequences of what I just did. No, it won't. Nothing you ever do will wipe out the fact that you have done an act. An act once done is an act done. That does not mean to say that you do not try to do something about putting right mistakes, which is a very different matter. Trying to put right what you have done is one thing. Trying to say, I haven't done something when you've done it is quite another. In other words, do not lie to yourself. Do not lie in your own mind. If you have done something, you have done it. No rite and no ritual can get you out of that. This places Christianity at something of a disadvantage to Buddhism, in that there is no savior in Buddhism. The Buddha is not a savior. He taught us how to be spiritually adult, how to accept what we had done and to be responsible for it insofar as we tried to put it right. There are a lot of people who think that if you punish someone, that will automatically wipe out what they have done. It can never wipe out the actual act. It can make them feel better. It can make you feel better for having done it, or worse, as the case may be, but it cannot wipe out the fact that an act was done. This is the point that is being got over. Not the fact that somebody should not pay for a crime, but the fact that the paying will not wipe out the crime. A lot of people make this very serious mistake. Therefore, no matter what you do, the consequences of your acts, the consequences of karma, you are going to reap. And however much you may regret what you have done, the fact remains that it is done. So you have to grow up spiritually and know that no third party can save you from your sins. You have to take the consequence of what you have done. And that is what comes with you down the centuries, down through the years, from life to life. This explains the inequalities of human beings. It explains why one is born rich and another is born poor. Why one is born sick and another is born well. Those of you who have been reading through the Book of Life must have been reading about some of this and the way in which it affects physical illness. It is important that you know that I am not laying down any of the rules on this. I am stuck with them as much as everybody else is. What I do, I will get the consequences of. The Zen master is not free of consequences. The only difference between him and another person is that he knows he's going to have the consequences, and the other person is usually looking for a way out of them, out, round, or under them. Is a very different matter. You cannot get out, round, or under karma. Karma is an inevitable law. If you do this, this will happen. Having had that happen, this will happen. And you get a chain reaction going. There is no other way out, round, or under it. So, the first time someone really does something about the spiritual side of himself, and he has what is called a first kensho, in Theravada Buddhism it is called becoming a stream entrant. Unfortunately, in this day and age, most of the Zen masters presently in this country and presently in Japan have not gone much further than having had the first of these three kensho's. Some have done more, but not enough for my own liking. Some have gone as far as the second, a few have gone to the third. The second one, the once returner, is one who is destined to be born in the human world only one more time, after birth in a celestial realm, and then to attain enlightenment here on the physical world. He has also eradicated the above three fetters, but has minimized the remaining seven to a greater degree than has the stream entrant. In other words, it is the next piece on. Now, in between each of these three, there's something very interesting happens. It's a cyclic thing. If you look in here at the end of the lotus blossom, those of you who have copies, you'll find that there is a number of pictures like this which show the cycles. Each time one really works upon oneself, one goes up and around the cycle and round the cycle. But what you need is a sort of long carrot, and you're going cutting round and round the carrot, and the rounds are getting smaller as you get to the end of the carrot. But it never stops in the circle. Do you understand what I'm saying? The cycles keep on going and going and going, and they keep getting smaller and smaller and smaller until there's nothing left. Carrot's a bad description.
Like threads on a screw?
Like threads on a screw, yes.
A circular path up a mountain.
Yeah, or a circular path up a mountain. Either way will do it. But they keep getting smaller. Now, when you first start this, the first sort of karma that comes up is extraordinarily coarse. Very, very coarse. And you have to deal with it absolutely. You have to deal with all its ramifications. One of the things I've given you to read between now and Monday is the first part of How to Grow a Lotus Blossom. And I have explained in that how I myself was doing this, and how I had to look at everything that I had done in the past and do everything I could to put it right. I could not take back what I personally had done, but I could do everything I could to try and minimize the results to other people. And the first thing was looking at all the people that I'd hurt and writing letters of apology to them. It doesn't matter who the heck was right or wrong. What matters is that I did something that hurt another person. You haven't got time to argue right and wrong in this. You've only got 70-odd years. It's not long enough to sit around and argue about this sort of thing. You really have to get in there and deal with all of it. So the first thing I started to do was to look at it and say, all right, I did these things. It's not who was right and who was wrong. I did them. I'm sorry I did them. This is the coarsest form. Then look at a lot of other things. Did you ever cheat when you were at school? Did you ever do this? Did you ever do that? Did you ever kick the cat? And be genuinely sorry for what you had done. And if possible, put it right. And then as you cleaned up all the various things that you had done in this life, as a result of the deepening meditation, memory banks opened. That is the only way I can put it. If you think about past life, you usually think of something that happened before this psychophysical being came into existence. But that is no further away in time than yesterday, or for that matter, the comments that I made 10 minutes ago. They're just as far away, because they're not here and now. Therefore, it should not be remarkable to anyone that past life, what happened in lives before this one, since this is not the real thing, it is hardly surprising that what happened in past lives comes up to be dealt with. You see, if this were the one and only, if this were the real me, then the only thing that matters is what I am doing now in this particular lifetime. And that is all I have to clean up. But if I accept that there is something beyond this psychophysical me, If I accept that there is an unborn, undying, and unchanging, then that has gone on before my birth and will go on after my death. And my birth and my death are simply two positions in time, two dates on a long, long calendar, which has its origins in infinity and its ending in infinity. I am merely... I used to have what, well, those lava lamps, you know, the sort of things, have you ever seen them? They sort of go up and down and they keep changing and they're all, it's all the same lovely mass of lava, and sometimes it goes up in big bubbles and sometimes in small bubbles and they all come down again and they disappear and they all come up again, and they're all totally different. It is one of the finest tools for teaching Zen I know of, and I was very annoyed when somebody threw the lava out. You can look at it and you can see the whole of how it is done in Zen. Beneath is this lovely, warm, live thing, the electric bulb, which for lack of better terminology we'll call the cosmic Buddha, the unborn, the undying, and the uncreated, that is putting the spirit into all this stuff. And it goes up in long, thin lumps and great big fat lumps and little droplets, but it all comes down into this lovely warm mass, which is kept warm by the spirit. It is all just one mass. Now, once you have realized that the true unborn, undying, uncreated is the spirit that keeps all that mass warm, then the memory banks do not have to be between these two points in time, which are our birth and death dates. And it is remarkable how fast and how easy in meditation it is to go back beyond those times and to find out what we did at previous times. But it is important to know why we find these out. Remember that enlightened action will never leave behind it any speck of dust, ever. So if we have something coming up from a past life, it is the result of an unenlightened act. So you are not likely to find out in a past life that you were some great and wondrous saint. You are very likely to find out you were one of the world's prize goons. And that you, and what it is coming up for is to teach you not to be a goon this time round. It is simply saying, look, you did this, therefore you have a proclivity to do this. Try not to make as big a mistake of it this time, or at any rate, learn from it, and not do it again. That is the purpose it comes up. And the only real Buddhist witchcraft, sorcery, I hesitate to use such words, but it's the best way to use, it's the best word I can come up with, the only real Buddhist sorcery in existence is to say, oh wow, I was such and such in a last life, I've got to do the same things this time round. Because that is exactly turning the wheel of the Dharma backwards. It's saying, all right, last time round I was an idiot and I'm going to be one this time too. And that is not the purpose for which you have past lives come up. They only come up to help you, so that you shall not make mistakes this time round. So what usually comes up in these first screw threads, which is a good description of screw, what comes up in these first screw thread cycles are the very coarsest of the ones you did. Incredibly coarse ones. And they can be extraordinarily painful. Far more painful than I like to think about. And they are very, very real. You are really and truly there when it happens. You have the physical pain, the physical sensations. I was talking about this some time back with, some years ago, with a Christian who was telling me about how marvelous some of the saints were, that they had the stigmata, and any time the stigmata appeared, there was this lovely smell of violets. And that was always a sign of sainthood. In Buddhism, that would not be so. Because you see, centuries upon centuries ago, there was a custom of fructifying the fields by crucifying a young man or a young woman, who was then hung with violets. This was one of their rites. And this particularly terrible form of death, if one meditates and one has suffered from it, is likely to come up as a past life. Now, if you've got a fairly religious person who is, shall we say, praying deeply or meditating deeply, who suddenly has this happen, the Buddhist would say, ah, a past life has come up. Now let us love and cleanse this particular stream of karma and go right on. He would not say that this person is a saint. Because you see, in Buddhism, such things are not important. They are signs of doing one's training properly, but they are not themselves a sign of sainthood. Having visions are great. They don't make you any different, in one sense, than you are right now. Dreaming that you are a millionaire one night does not make you a penny richer in the morning when you wake up. But what it may do is tell you something about something that happened in the past. Therefore, such things as stigmata and the like are explained by in Buddhism as signs of past life experience. That someone, in other words, is a very religious person and is working hard on their religion, and it's an excellent sign, but it does not make a person into a saint. You have to get to the end of the screw before that happens. It is not likely to happen before you, when this sort of very coarse, because this is very coarse karma, first comes up. And many people will have very, very nasty past life experiences come up in the early stages. Somewhere down the line, we picked up karma at times when we were hung or when we were executed in some other way, or when we died in a car accident or fell off a cliff, and what our experiences were then, and whether or not we rejected the cosmic Buddha at that time, whether we were suffering from anger, fear, or despair at that time, will condition what is happening with us at the time of the past life coming up. Because whatever we experienced at the time of death, if it shut us off from the unborn, undying, and uncreated, then that becomes the fishy smell in the bag for the next time round. And getting out the fishy smell in the bag, which I talked of last time, is what this is all about. So here is the first stink coming up, shall we say, somebody's past life. And what we have to do is recognize that at that time we were in despair, or we did turn away from the cosmic Buddha, or we were so incredibly angry at what someone was doing with us that we died badly, and therefore left behind a stink to be carried on next time round. I'm going to have to leave you to do the next two paragraphs on what I've just said, because this next piece is terribly important. There are three periods into which, avoid the company of those who are deluded and ignorant with regard to the truth of karmic consequence, the three states of existence and good and evil. It is obvious that the law of cause and effect is not answerable to my personal will, for without fail evil is vanquished and good prevails. If it were not so, Buddhism would never have appeared and Bodhidharma would never have come from the West. There are three periods into which the karmic consequence of good and evil fall. One is the consequence experienced in this present world, The second is the consequence experienced in the next world, and the third consequence experienced in the world after the next one. One must understand this very clearly before undertaking any training in the way of the Buddhas and patriarchs. Otherwise, mistakes will be made by many and they will fall into heresy. In addition to this, their lives will become evil and their suffering will be prolonged. Now, the reason why it is important to understand this is, supposing a person is really working hard on his or her religious training, and suddenly some weird thing out of the blue hits him with all the force it can possibly hit him with, and he sits back and says, well, why is God doing this to me? Or why is the cosmic Buddha doing this to me? Look at me, I'm trying to live a good life. Yes, but there are karmas that come from the past, which were not cleaned up in the past. And because they were not dealt with, because the consequences were not dealt with, they are going to come out and they are going to hit you. And if you blame the cosmic Buddha for that, all you are going to do is add confusion to a situation that is already confused. Therefore, if you undertake training, you should know that all the past karma will immediately come up and smack you. So don't be surprised if you start to meditate really seriously. If everything that can happen does happen, and you get hit by everything and the kitchen sink, you should know that that is normal. It is not abnormal, because you are beckoning to it. Anytime a person settles down to look at a wall to truly meditate, he is doing this to his karmic smell. He is saying, let me look in the bag and see what there is in the way of bad fish. And of course he finds the bad fish. The bag itself is perfect. There's nothing wrong with the bag. There is no basic sin in the bag. There is just that which has not been cleaned up. And supposing you find in this life absolutely no reason for what is happening, then you may very possibly find it in the one before this. And if that doesn't happen, in the one before that. You never know when a karma from left field is going to hit you. And one of the reasons they use the kyosaki in the Zendo, people are sitting there meditating quietly and thinking how good they're doing, and suddenly somebody wanders around in a Soto temple and out of the blue gives you a clobber with a dirty great oaken stave. And you think, what was that for? And you can either blame it on your feet, you can blame it on the doyen who hit you, but if you really think about it, or you can blame it on the system, which is what a lot of them do, or if you really think about it, you can realize that this is a symbol saying, don't think that you've made it all the way. There's still something that can come out and hit you from left field. There is a lot to be learned from past life experience, a lot that you need to study in great detail about each of you as an individual. Now, the same thing is true of future life, because some people get very clear cognition of future life experience. But again, you have to be very careful here, because what you get as future life is not pre-knowledge of what will happen, but pre-knowledge of what probably will happen if you keep going as you are right now. Because the past life is conditioning what you are doing now. And what you are doing now is conditioning what will happen in the future. So you have the complete and absolute control over this thing. If I continue as I am going, I will probably die on such and such, around such and such a time, of such and such a type of thing. But I could walk out on the street and some idiot come round the corner on one wheel and kill me. All this is showing a possibility of things as they are now. But supposing I'm out there, things are no longer as they are now. There's some idiot on one wheel. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's very important not to get stuck with the idea that future, understanding of future life, seeing pictures of future life in meditation, are what is actually going to happen. That is a possibility contingent on what's going on right now. So pre-knowledge is not pre-knowledge as people think of it. It is important to understand this when dealing with karma, because it explains the steps of what is called dependent origination, on what happened then, this occurred, and because this occurred, and because that occurred, another thing occurred, and so on and so on. It is the now that always conditions the occurrence. We always say hindsight is an exact science. You look back, you can see what you did wrong in there. But what we do now is the science that we need to strive to get as perfect as possible. Right. So be careful of past, present, and future life. And know who is in charge of what is going on. There is not some external being to you that is conditioning this. What happened to you is what you yourself caused. What will happen to you is what you yourself do now, or are doing at any specific minute. It's very important to understand that. None of us have more than one body during this lifetime. Therefore, it is indeed tragic to lead a life of evil as a result of heresy, for it is impossible to escape from karmic consequence if we do evil on the assumption that by not recognizing an act as evil, no bad karma can accrue to us. Maybe it's the climate of the Bay Area, I don't know. But it seems to breed people who believe that life is a perpetual spring and that there is no consequence and even more, no need for responsibility. All you have to do is love everybody and everything will be right. Yes, you need to love everybody, but there is more to it than that. You cannot give up responsibility. You cannot say, well, I don't recognize this act as evil, and since I don't recognize it as evil, no bad karma can come out of it for me. Bad karma will come out of it for you if you do something wrong, whether you recognize it as evil or not. That your intention was good is fine, but you're still going to get the consequence of doing it, no matter what that consequence is. You cannot escape from karma. Who's got some questions? I've got 2 or 3 minutes left. There are all sorts of things people can do, or which they seem to do. I and my master before me and my disciples will never cash something in for somebody else. After all, they've got it because that's what they are to learn from. You see, the original koan, and this is the explanation of the koan system. The original koan of the Buddha was, why is there birth, old age, disease, and death? And he got 4 answers, which he called his enlightenment. There isn't a specific thing to call enlightenment. There are certain answers of which one can be certain, that is, which are the results of meditation. And those answers are the answers to the koan. And the answers to why is there birth, old age, disease, and death were the 4 noble truths. Suffering exists, suffering's cause, the cessation of suffering, and the Noble Eightfold Path. So, why is there birth? The answer is because suffering exists. Why is there suffering existing? Because we created karma, and it is the karma that caused this psychophysical being to come into existence. What causes a being to come into existence, or the skandhas? Form or matter, sensation or feeling, thoughts or perceptions, impulses or activity, and consciousness. Now, without the consciousness, a being cannot come into existence. And it is the karma, the smell in the bag, so to speak, that puts the consciousness into the being. And it is feeling that reaps the karma. And it is feeling that causes the suffering. That simplifies it far too much. We're going to have to go into it in a lot more detail over the weeks. But the first one was suffering exists. That is the cause of birth. What is the cause of disease? Well, if you want to cure disease, you must cease from suffering, i.e. you must start doing something about your karma, i.e. you must take a look at why there is karma and discover that it is the karma that makes a person sick, which is what I'm talking about in the Book of Life. Old age. If you do not wish to become old and die, then you must cease from suffering completely. If you find the cessation of suffering, then there is no old age, and if you keep the Noble Eightfold Path, there is eventually no death. So you've got a koan that's going one way and an answer that's going the other. See what I'm getting at? That is how the koan worked for him. Now, each one of us comes with our own particular koan, which, when we look into what happened in the past, when we find suffering's cause for ourselves, we find what our particular koan really is. And as we look at one thing, so we find the answer which goes in the opposite direction. And the two meet in the circle and dissolve. A master can affect a disciple's karma very seriously. Anybody else got anything? Yeah. If he makes any more, he's got to deal with it. But he has taken care of the rest of it. I'll give you the sign of the third Kensho, the non-returner, one destined to be born in a particular celestial realm of his own. You know, of his own. Not that there's some place airy-fairy in the sky where he's going to. It's a place of his own, where he will attain to enlightenment. He will not return to the human world again. In addition to the above three fetters, he has eradicated another two. And these are the signs of having had a third Kensho. See, you can actually see the signs in people. These are the signs. One, lustful desire. This means even the minutest grain of desire for sensual pleasure has now vanished. You remember, I think it was our friend here who asked me the question, what happens? And I said, one who has tasted Dharma could never possibly want physical love. There would be no point. Who would want to... who wants to eat McDonald's? Who wants to eat a McDonald's hamburger when he's once tasted a really well-cooked meal? He may still eat the McDonald's hamburger, I would imagine, but I can't picture him enjoying it. And when you go the whole way with this, there is absolutely no desire at all. It's just, it's not horrific, it's just, who want it? It's not, imagine it as a dirty thing or a nasty thing, it's, why? There's no point. So that's the first one. The second one, irritation. This means the smallest possibility for a person to be aroused to true anger. That has gone. Those are the two signs of a non-returner, a person who has had a third Kensho. The fourth one, usually people don't make this one until death, but sometimes there are very, very rare people who have done this one in this lifetime. The Buddha himself did. Enlightened one. one who has eradicated all the 10 spiritual fetters, his is the last birth. After the dissolution of the physical body, there is no more birth for him in any plane of existence. The remaining 5 that he has now eradicated are delight in forms such as meditation, the condition of being absorbed in ecstasy and bliss born of meditation in the level of absorption. In other words, even that has gone. 2, delight in formless meditation, which is somewhat similar to the other but on a much higher level. Pride or ego, comparing himself with others. He has no longer distracting thoughts and has no longer any ignorance. That is, ignorance of the true nature of things. No desire to manipulate or trick beings by making life appear to them as permanent, happy, substantial, or beautiful, preventing them from seeing that everything is really impermanent, liable to suffering, void of I, mine or self, and basically impure. They are very rare, the last type. That answer your question?
Can I ask another one? What started the whole chain of karma? I mean, what?
I asked that question of my master shortly after I got to Japan. And he stretched and said, by accident, somebody started karma. Accident, someone started the chain of karma. As I understand how it works, and this is from my own personal experience, karma is always very slightly saddened love. A person who was doing something so right, who wanted to do so much that he went very, very slightly overboard at doing it, and sent it from its pinnacle just slightly over the other side. And this tiny little bit was exaggerated until down the centuries it became quite horrible. I have had it in my own experience. When you read through the lotus blossom, you'll see what I'm talking about. Very slightly, a good thing that went very slightly wrong. I'm sure you've had many experiences of that. I certainly have. And you have to wipe out that tiny little thing. Go ahead.
Inheritance or evolution or any of those things relate to rebirth in terms of karma, right? Or does it?
It does very, very much. Zen goes along extraordinarily well with the theories of Darwin. In fact, that is used by Zen masters to explain creation. Whenever anyone has asked that question, it doesn't argue with it at all. Yes.
If, for instance, one dies in a state of despair,
yes,
then when you go to cleanse it, will it be the same despair?
The same despair will come up, and what you have to know is that it is not the real you. That which stopped the death and which being a perfect and good death and caused this present being to come into existence was not the real you. Mm-hmm. If you can know that and say, this is not me, this is just a perfume that has come from a past life because of a mistake that was made at death, and just love the being intensely and say, no, I'm not going to allow you to take me over, because I am not going to despair anymore. There's a lot more to it than that. There are actual ceremonies in which you can do this. Or you can invent your own. You don't have to stick to the original.
So when you come up with karma and you wish to take care of it in this life, there are certain procedures.
Yes, that's what you're going to be reading about this weekend. Yep, there are very definite procedures. And it will come up in various ways. Usually it comes up in feeling. And the old Theravada words for explaining karma is no doer is there who does the deed, nor is there one who who reaps the fruit. Feeling alone is the reaper. There is no real one that reaps the fruit. In other words, one of the five skandhas, feeling, just feeling, or emotion, is the side that gets the fruit of it. Therefore, when it comes up, that perfume, it is feeling that usually gets it. Now, if it were an incredibly strong one, you may get more than just that. You may get visualization. It may actually seem to materialize, and this is the explanation of ghosts, so-called ghost appearances.
If you have an incident which you must cleanse in this life,
yes.
Is it possible to do that?
Oh, yes, very definitely. If it's someone whom you've hurt, or something that can be dealt with by a visit or a phone call or a letter or something of that sort, then that's the way you do it.
Now that's writing a mistake.
Yes.
That's not avoiding the consequences.
No.
What you're saying is that to cleanse karma, you accept the consequences
of,
but you write the mistake.
Yes.
But
and cleansing, if it's in this lifetime, the other person with whom it has been, with whom you've been involved in it, by simply telling that person or getting their forgiveness, that will automatically cleanse it.
And does that carry on?
No. Once you've dealt with that, that's done. Finished. But there's still, you made the mistake. It's like putting a stained piece of or a dirty piece of washing in a laundry machine, and sometimes you can't get, well, you can see just a faint shadow, you know, where it was. It's a clean garment, but it isn't new any longer. It's been washed.
Can I make a comment on that?
Yeah.
The way in which that sometimes manifests is that you can't expect any particular results when you try to cleanse something like that that affects someone in this life. In other words, you may make your offering, they don't have to accept it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's one of the saddest things you have to find out.
And in that sense, they can wish to continue the karma.
Yeah, but that's their problem.
That's their problem.
That's their headache.
But it can still affect you.
Well, yes, but still you won't carry on that particular.
Right.
You see, I wrote to one person. And along the following lines, there never was a genuine quarrel between us. And if either of us perpetuates it, we are wrong. We both know that this letter doesn't need to be sent, but I'm sending it anyway. And I got a letter back telling me everything that the person was doing right now, and nothing on the subject whatsoever. And it would appear, I pray I'm not making more karma by saying this, but it would appear that he seems to be continuing in the same direction. That's not my problem. I made the offering. If he wants to continue it, I can't stop him. Yeah.
What about not being born again in human form?
Buddhism is rather nasty. One of these. This book, by the way, I should tell you about. One of the things that is unfortunate in Buddhism is that everybody is expected to write down and publish enough copies of for his own friends and disciples his experiences of any one or all of the three or four kenshos. And they have to be distributed absolutely free, which is why over here in the West, we only ever seem to get very dull books on Buddhism. You see, the real ones that tell you the truth can only be distributed free. And since everybody is fairly broke, that means that even the richest man probably doesn't produce more than a couple of hundred. I have a very fair number of these, which have been done by friends of mine, or my master, or my fellow disciples with him. This is one that is done in English, which I do wish we could get copies for everybody who ever studies Buddhism in this country, along with several others, because it makes so very clear what is going on. And it gives the experience of each person, and then everybody examines his, oh, that was the same as, and you all check it out and see if what you've got is, and you find out that everybody's got exactly the same thing, in essence. Now, I brought that up because somebody may want to get this book, and it's not possible. This is about a very great monk who had all four kensho's. He is a Dutanga monk in Theravada. And he is speaking here of what he did when in the wilds with animals. The realization of many more new truths occurred to him while he was staying in this cave, both internal truths and unlimited external ones. He was encouraged and took delight in this practice, taking no notice of the lapse of time. More and more internal truths dawned upon him like a mountain stream gushing forth in the rainy season. On clear afternoons he strolled along the winding tracks under the shade of trees, enjoying the scenery and solitude while developing his insight meditation. He would return to his cave late in the afternoon, enjoying the company of the various kinds of animals that roamed freely in the fertile area. This man died in 49, by the way. It's not all that long ago. The atmosphere was wonderfully hospitable, each going their own ways and minding their own business. There was no room for fear, since all now took each other for granted, knowing that none meant any other harm. The Venerable Akan said he took delight in their company, always radiating his loving kindness towards them. They all share the all-inclusive sufferings of birth, old age, illness, and death, none having any advantage over the rest in this respect. The level of inner development in man and animals is different. This difference, however, can sometimes be found working in a paradoxical manner, with some animals being essentially more mature spiritually than some men. Which is a rather pointed statement. Due to the occasional fruiting of some evil karma, men temporarily suffer its effects in taking an animal birth. Even in the world of man, parallels may be seen in those who are living in miserable states, almost no better than that of animals. They have to undergo such suffering in these states until the evil karma is exhausted, or until there is the occasion for the ripening of virtuous karma, replacing the evil one. A Buddhist is thus advised against treating animals with contempt, since there is good and evil karma in all sentient beings, belonging to man and animals alike. According to Buddhism, the only, i.e. minimum, guarantee against rebirth as an animal is the path of the stream winner, i.e. the first kensho, called in Pali Sotapanna, which the Buddha said is indescribably superior to world conquest, attainment to heaven, and even to conquest of all the three worlds put together. Does that answer your question?
What's it on the line with the animals?
Yeah.
I don't understand. I heard things in there about animals and karma. Do animals actually create good and bad karma?
They have what is called in the secret teachings of Zen, single enlightenment. Animals are just themselves, therefore they are already enlightened. As a result of karma as humans, they have to put up perhaps with an animal existence. In other words, they pay for what they got up to. Just by being themselves.
So that
because they are then in a situation where they cannot hear the truth, but the enlightenment is single. It is just they have no means of doing anything other than being a perfect dog or cat or horse.
So if they don't create any bad karma, then you would never experience.
I wonder sometimes when I look at my dog. I'm not completely sure of that.
Ourself to human and animal life, or does it include other forms that we could come back as a rock, a tree?
Well, everything in one sense is at a disadvantage to the human state. That is why it is said that the human state is even better than being in heaven. Because in heaven, life's so enjoyable, you're likely to become, complacent, correct. The danger of being in a heaven is the complacency. What's the point of doing anything more? But in a human state, you know that you don't really want to stay like this, but you're still doing the best of what the stones and the rocks and the dogs and the cats are doing. After all, if I am a stone, I could be picked up by somebody and cemented into a wall, which I might not much like, or somebody may take a sledgehammer to me. I don't think I'd like either of those things particularly. You could be made a pet rock of. But you see what I'm saying? It's. I think the human is the... all taken for granted. Yes, that's even worse. Go ahead.
Karma is bad.
Okay. No, karma can be good. It's what we ourselves have done down the centuries.
Karma is something impersonal law. It's just like a law of physics, or you know, like a law of biology. It's just like the law of gravity. It happens because when gravity happens because there's mass, and karma happens simply there's action and reaction on a spiritual level.
Well, maybe I don't understand what the cosmic Buddha is. I felt when you were talking that it was from which everything came.
Yes.
Think of it's beyond good and bad.
Were you at last week's lecture?
Think of the cosmic Buddha as the ocean with which you're trying to be one. And for centuries, instead of being one, you're trying to plow through it. Okay? And as you plow through it, you create a wake, a wave. And as you keep going ahead of that wave, you can avoid the consequences. But when you stop and turn around, the wave will hit you. Bam. And that's karma. It's just a consequence of what you're doing. It's Buddhism, it's called creating waves upon the wave of the sea. It's only you that does it. It's not, in that sense, we call it evil because it knocks us down. It's bad karma, we don't like it. But it's teaching us. And it's one way to look at it.
And therefore it is in and of.
That's right.
The way I've always understood it is this. We always know that bad karma, past karma, if it was bad, will affect us. What I am trying to do is, it's great when I have good karma from the past come, but I'm working awful hard to make sure that what comes in the future shall not be bad. Because some poor creature will pick up this bag of fish next time round, if I've not cleaned the bag up enough, and be stuck with whatever I've done. And I don't like that thought very much. I don't want to sentence somebody to the consequences of my faults. Yes?
When you're working on the karma of this life, easy to see, as you put it, you know, the coarse things. I mean, there's mm-hmm. a lot of things that we can see clearly that we're doing. However, it seems to me that it's very often that we get into situations that things don't work out, and we try and understand what we have done in order to do something about it, or in order not to repeat that mistake. But if it's somehow part of the koan, or perhaps the koan arises at that point, it sometimes is very difficult to know. That seems to me. Something gets in the way of understanding what thing is.
And you frequently don't always know that what you are doing is a wrong thing. I can give you a really good case in point of this from myself. When I was working on myself 3 years ago, very seriously over in the Priory, when I was very ill, the precept that kept coming up for me as the one that really needed working on was telling the truth at all times. And by nature, I am not a liar. And I couldn't work out why this kept coming up. I mean, where was I lying? What was I doing? And it was then that I realized how subtle this actually gets. Because it's not just a matter of coarsely lying, telling that which is not true. It's a matter of not speaking out when you should speak out. It's a matter of, as in my case, one day I blew up at a government official in Sacramento and said, I'm not going to do this any longer. And he didn't know what the heck I was talking about. Because, I mean, everybody did it. Well, you've got a form. Yes, you can't get it all on, but that's all right. Put down as much as you can. Yes, well, we like to keep things neat and tidy here. So just don't say these two words in your mind. Go along with the rest when everybody else is doing it. No. That is lying. If a form says, say everything, tell everything that you've done, shall we say, from the time you grew up to now, or give all your employers, that's what it means. It doesn't say put in as many as you can get on the form. And if an official tells you, yes, that's all right, that's what everybody does, well, maybe that's what everybody does. So do you have to go along and lie with it? Do you see how subtle it gets in the end? Getting caught in what everybody else does?
I do. I feel like I have a long way to go.
But it gets incredibly subtle after a bit. Because that makes you a liar. And you're not a liar. Yeah, go ahead.
It's interesting, of course, speaking about karma.
I'll finally add one thing to that. You're not going to have a kensho, first, second, or third, until you take it the whole way. It's no good cleaning up the coarse stuff. Well, I mean, you've got to clean up the coarse stuff, but that's not enough. You've then got to take it all the way into these very tiny threads on the circles until you literally, you go beyond the end of the point of the screw. It's not enough just to pick up the big things. I didn't understand this until I was over in Japan, and I was being out with everybody else digging weeds, and I was pulling up these big weeds, great, it's easy. And there was a hurried little monk who kept coming around behind me saying, there's a tiny one there. What about that little one? These were tiny little green things. I mean, darn it, who wants to pick all them up? You're not going to make it until you pick them all up. The cosmic Buddha is not going to open his storehouse unless you go the whole way. And you see, we are at a disadvantage in one respect with the cosmic Buddha, because he's got time and other things on his side. He can wait.
If I understand you correctly, what you just said, you clean up whatever you see, no matter how large or how small, and
correct,
not to be worried that you may be missing some huge chunks because you can't see it if there's a little weed in front of you.
Then that's the weed you pick up. Yeah. Do what you see in front of you. People say, I don't know how to move. I don't know which way to go. And the answer is put one foot in front of the next. I've often told the story of being asked, how many sound moves could I make in chess? And I said, two. And the person said, that's one more than me. If you can make one sound move at any time, you are completely free. It's all it takes, all of life, is one sound move. Every minute making one sound move. That is why Zen is saying just living, true life, is all of Zen. One sound move. Yes?
In Buddhism then, until you have cleaned up all the screws,
mm-hmm. It's one big screw.
You cannot be a beginning entrant, extreme
entrant? No. I do not know the yardstick. by which the cosmic Buddha measures things, all right? He seems to do it totally differently on everybody else, and that's because everybody has got a totally different bag of fish. And only you know what's in your bag of fish, like only I know what's in my bag of fish. After a certain distance, you clean up a certain amount of this stuff, and suddenly you become a stream entrant as a result of that. And then more comes up, and you become a once returner, and then more comes up, and you become a non-returner. And so, and it gets more subtle, until it is so subtle.
You don't die in between each
step? Physically, no. You can. There does come a time at the third kensho when you are asked the question, what is your purpose for living? Because having cleaned up all of the stuff, right down to the minuscule stuff that doesn't really matter, that's not going to affect you anyway, which is stuff that's nice to get cleaned up, which really isn't, doesn't matter very much. When you get down to that, then you have that which caused this being to come into existence is now no longer there. Therefore, the consciousness that is there no longer has that which stimulates it. Do you understand what I'm saying? So whose is this consciousness? Whose is now this being? What is your purpose for living? The purpose for living up to now was to clean up this karmic mess, because this karma needed cleaning. But now there is no karma of that ilk to clean. So what is your purpose for living? And you better have an answer when that comes. And it better be a good one. A very good one. Yes, you can get to that stage. I've never known anybody die yet, by the way. Okay? Well, at the second one, the question comes, first and second, the question comes up a bit, and it usually comes up, and the answer is usually to be a monk who is a doctor or a lawyer or a nurse or a teacher or whatever. But I think that at the third one, the only answer that can come up ever is to be a monk. Ever. Because what is a monk other than someone who does not create karma? Karma is an interesting subject. Yes?
What about the Bodhisattva vow? Would that be the ultimate answer?
The way I understand the Bodhisattva and the other, from what I got in the Far East, and this book certainly confirms it, and so does a number of others of them, the Bodhisattva is someone who has undergone a lot of training and spends most of his time teaching others how to do the same sort of things. But at some time or other, since we are in the business for both self and other, a person has to take time off to continue his own training. And in that sense, we are always at some time a bodhisattva, at some time an arahant, sometime bodhisattva, sometime arahant. The danger of being a bodhisattva at all times, in the normal sense of the term, is that one can become a do-gooder in one's own head. And that can be very dangerous. I had some problems with that, actually, until I got this book, which finally ratified for me at a certain point in my own training that I had not been completely sure of. Where is it?
Is that vow something that came later on in Buddhism?
No, I don't think so. It's certainly the signs of it are to be found in Theravada Buddhism. I think it was made too much of at a later date, in the sense of separated too much from the arahant. I think that the two, the arahant and the bodhisattva, are sort of the reverse and obverse of the same coin. Just sometimes one side is uppermost and another time the other side is uppermost.
Should one try to combine then meditation with good works?
Yes, very definitely. And doing the best one can, really. You know, the motto of the World Federation of Buddhists is interesting. Very interesting indeed. We hope for the best, expect the worst, and do the possible. Well, I know this much. One of the things that used to worry me intensely was when any of my disciples got things wrong or went in a wrong direction that I knew was going to damage their training. And I used to be like a man who was constantly chasing cabbage leaves that were going downstream, you know what I mean? I'd pick up one here and I'd grab one there, and I was sort of, in the end I needed the assistance of an intelligent octopus to collect them all. And one day I decided, no, it's not my problem if they go downstream. All I can do is tell them what is true. That they do or do not wish to follow, I cannot force. So my job as a bodhisattva is always to tell people what is true, but they have the free will to accept it or reject it. It's not my business.
Yeah. I wonder if you would talk a little bit about karma and guilt.
Karma and guilt. Well, since karma is inevitable, guilt is a waste of time. It's no good feeling guilty about something. If you've done it, you've done it. So feeling guilty about it is not going to do any good at all. All you can really do is accept the fact that you've done it. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, I do that. I guess I'm thinking, what if a person just feels guilty a lot? Maybe when
he does the very best he can. Usually if there's a lot of guilt, it means that he has not done everything in his power to clean up something, or that something more needs to be done to clean it up. But you do have to be very careful that you don't become what I call a centipede with washcloths, one in each hand, one in each leg, because you can get so involved in this that in the end you're constantly washing and washing everything in easy reach, and you never stop. There does have to be an acceptance of the fact that something once done cannot, it can never be as if it had not been done. Do you understand what I'm...
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of people feel, as a result of guilt, they've got to make it as if it had never been done. That can't be. You've got to accept that it was done. And not confuse that with the guilt. Go on.
Something that has always struck me about guilt is that it seems to accompany a sort of fear, a fear over what is done or may be done or might happen as a consequence.
Yeah.
And the thing about sitting and really facing what you do and learning to live by Zen is to learn to live
without
fearlessness.
Fear.
And to live by Zen means to move with courage. It's very important to move with courage. And guilt becomes a sort of an irrelevant thing in Zen if you really get into it.
The thing that I fear most with guilt, I don't fear so much that it'll turn people into cowards, that they won't clean something up, which it sometimes does, but I don't fear that nearly so much as the fact that they will become possessed by it and sort of be the centipede with washcloths trying to expunge what was done. And the biggest problem for me with guilt was having to accept the fact that what I'd done I could never completely clean up what I'd done, however hard I tried, because I'd done it. There was no way that could be done. And I had to be content to say, all right, now I must leave it, because I've done everything in my power to clean it up, so I mustn't be guilty any longer.
this seems silly, I guess, but I guess first one would have to feel that it was wrong what you had done before you would feel guilty, wouldn't you?
There's an instinct in every living human being, most animals too, which knows what is wrong and what is right. That which makes you feel at dis-ease, unease, is that most of us are so angry with ourselves for having done something. Guilt creates anger with self.
Yeah. It's saying, I am bad, mm-hmm. rather than, this I did this and this was bad. That's where the fear comes in.
Yeah, this was not a good thing to do. I shouldn't have done it. I can never be as if I hadn't done it. I did it. Yes, go ahead.
It seems to me that, for myself anyway, the karma that I feel is not kind of stuff where I can leave people or anything bad like that, although I certainly have done that. But some kind of a fear of facing certain things about myself that I don't like, or being willing to change them, like I'm afraid to ride in a car, for instance, and I never really get through that or past it or beyond that.
That should clear up with meditation. You may not like what you'll find out, but it'll very probably come up and sort of hit you, sort of say boo at you over the wall. Don't run when that happens. It can't harm you. That will very probably come up there. Fears like that, stray fears, stray allergies. Lots of those things are cleaned up with meditation. Especially allergies, which have really been sort of things that have been sown in very, very early childhood as a result of something that happened in babyhood, and therefore we are reacting to it as a self-protection. So fear of riding in cars, you could possibly be reacting to something of which I know nothing and which took place so long ago that you don't remember. That's one of the nice things when I said it opens the doors of memory back down the line. But you may not like what you'll find. In fact, I pretty well guarantee you won't. Not because I'm saying this to you specifically as you, but because I've never bumped into anybody yet that did. This isn't a personal prediction.
The other one is, and I mean, I'm supposed to be now, is to discuss your personal views on Rinzai as
Rinzai and Sotong.
You explain it a little bit.
It's very, very simple. Some people are suitable for Rinzai. Some people are suitable for Sotong. Some are fine for Christianity. Others are fine for Judaism. You pay your money and you take your pick. You choose, in other words, whichever one is perfect for you. And you go with it. It's not a matter of this one's right and that one's wrong. It's a matter of I'm tall and you're short and he's fat and I'm thin. And we all need different clothes to fit us. The difference between them is primarily one of what is suitable for a temperament rather than what is not suitable for a temperament. They're really one of the big things that people don't realize with regard to the 249 schools of Zen, schools of Buddhism that were in Japan when I left it in 69, and there are probably a fair few more by now. They come and go like mushrooms on a tree. What people don't realize is that they all agree on certain fundamental things. The cosmic Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, Four Noble Truths, and what the Buddha saw and heard and taught. Thereafter, they all go at it totally differently. One says you should sit looking at a wall. Another says, no, you should sit looking at somebody else. Third says you should do it standing up. A fourth says, no, you want to sit under a waterfall. A fifth says this, and a sixth says that. But what they're disagreeing on is method.